there's echoes of biology in the way people talk about mountains. So people will talk about the mountains having veins and having blood and there being energy that flows in the veins of the mountain. So it looks lifelike or lively, but it's not biological life. I'm also thinking of it in the way that mountains do things and that mountains create. So there's a poetry reader, Mokzaya, and his thought about how poetry is produced. It's never produced through a single human author. It's produced through collaboration between human author and mountain, or human author and steppe or grass.
You're listening to Buddhist Studies Footnotes, and I'm Frances Garrett. Today I'm speaking with Jessica Madison Piscata. Jessica is a visiting assistant professor in anthropology and environmental studies at Oberlin College. Her research is on the relationships between humans and geological landscapes on the peripheries of Cold War empires. Today we'll be talking about how she's looked at the intersection of poetic practice and geological sociality in Eastern Mongolia. We'll also learn about her new research on radon health spas operating on former uranium mining sites in the Czech Republic, and how this ties into Mongolian understandings of the concept of energy.
My work currently is looking at the social intimacies of humans and mineral landscapes, especially around the marginalized areas of the post-socialist world. So that has mostly been in Mongolia, and then recently I've been working in the Czech Republic as well. There's a story of how I ended up doing anthropology in Mongolia, and the story involves poetry and mountains, which is really central to my work in the region and central to how people in Mongolia engage with mineral landscapes. So I actually didn't start as an anthropologist. I got my undergraduate degree and MFA in creative writing and poetry. After I got my MFA, I was living in New York City, and you know, it was right after the market crash. And so I thought that I would join the Peace Corps. So I joined the Peace Corps. They sent me to Mongolia in 2011. And while I was there, I was working as a English teacher in Sukhbatar Aimag, which is Sukhbatar province. So that's a province in the east of Mongolia, right near the Chinese border. And while I was doing this, I still kept up my interest in poetry. So, you know, the winters in Mongolia are very long and very cold. So over the winter, I started experimenting with trying to translate poetry. And the poets of the region where I was working, which is Sukhbatar, and also there's a small town a little bit further east called Dedagong. The poets of that region are very interested in exploring their own relationship with landscape, particularly exploring their own relationship with the Dedagong landscape, with mountains, with other geological forms. So I was translating this poetry, and I just felt as if I was missing something. Like there was a context that I could kind of get, and I could have people kind of explain to me. But I was like, no, I need to get much more into really like exploring the context of this in an academic way. And that's what led me to anthropology. So then when I finished my 2 years in Mongolia, came back to the United States, got my PhD in anthropology at UC Santa Cruz. And that's the story of how I ended up doing this research in Mongolia.
One of the themes of your dissertation is this moving away from this separation between nature and social life, mm-hmm. and what you call the life-centric view of nature. Could you tell us a bit about how you came to these ideas before we get into the details about it? What made you start thinking about how might you appreciate these non-living geologic forms?
I guess that I'll start with is there is a political answer to that question, which is in 2013, mineral extraction in Mongolia started really amping up and a lot of development started amping up. And one of the big projects that was being planned was this new airport outside Ulaanbaatar, now open. It's very, very state-of-the-art airport. But there was some conflict because as they were building the road from Ulaanbaatar, which is the capital of Mongolia, out to the airport, the road's planned route was going to interfere with some of the sacred mountains or the worshipped mountains, might be a better word, to not sort of reinscribe this sacred, non-sacred binary.
some of the worshipped mountains around Ulaanbaatar. And I was talking to an American, and he was saying how ridiculous it was that people were concerned about having this road cut through these mountains because they think the mountains are alive. Isn't that stupid, right? This kind of thing. There's a fundamental misunderstanding that happens when having these conversations in English about what alive means. Because oftentimes if a Mongolian person is telling someone in English about these worshipped mountains or sacred mountains, whatever you want to call them, about these more than non-living geological forms, they'll use the word alive. And so there's this misunderstanding that happens that this person thinks that they're referring to something biologically living. But in Mongolian, you would not use the word M, meaning life. You would not use that to describe a mountain. You would use some other term. People use the term magnetic, worshipped. They wouldn't use the term alive. So that was one thing where I'm like, okay, so it's not alive. It's not dead. It's not exactly non-living, but it's lively, right? It's got this kind of, it's got a cosmopolitical life. It has an intimate life. It has an affective pull on people and people have relationships with it, but it's not, you know, biologically living. So there's this kind of fundamental misunderstanding that especially happens around issues with extraction, issues with development, where people think that people are talking about mountains being literally alive. So that's part of it. And then the second part is about a mountain, Altanowo. And Altanowo, to me personally, and to the people that I know, to my really good friends who I've built friendships over many years with, Altanowo is really, really, really important. So there was no way I was going to write about Mongolia without writing about Altanowo. But the character of Altanowo and the character of these mountains is like, when you go there and when you engage with them, especially with other people, they're so obviously more than non-living that it's kind of hard to deny just through their affective power and through their power to create relationships.
So you say they're more than non-living.
Yeah.
You mean, can you just kind of unpack that a little bit?
Sure. So that's kind of a callback to the more than human gesture. What I mean when I say that is that they exceed and that there's excesses to these categories of living and non-living. And I'm drawing on Elizabeth Pavanelli's geontologies when I'm talking about that, that there are systems of power drawn from Enlightenment thinking that divide things into living, non-living, dead, never living, and that these mountains exceed all those categories.
So that's why you said just a few minutes ago that you wanted to avoid reinscribing sacred and non-sacred binaries.
Yes.
Because in the story that you told about the NGO worker being frustrated that people didn't want the mountain to be crossed or destroyed or something, the response might often be like, well, the mountain has sacred deities living in it or living on it or something like that.
Mm-hmm. When we say sacred, I feel like it puts these things into a category of religion, which can be opposed to a category of the secular, and also into this category of belief and fictionality, like fictionalizes it a little bit. It also flattens these practices, which I think aren't always necessarily just religious. A lot of them are kind of practical, everyday, I wouldn't say mundane, but imminent relationships, right? Like the relationships people have with this mountain isn't with the spirit of the mountain or isn't with some sort of disaggregated thing. It's with the actual mountain, the body of the mountain itself. And the mountain has these extra capabilities, but they come from the actual materiality of it being a mountain. And so sacred, I feel like, lends this fictionality to it. And it flattens the way people actually engage with the mountain.
Yeah, that's interesting because one of the things I really like about your work is how you also talk about minds. And so I think if you had just studied the mountain, people would still be able to understand that as, oh yeah, sacred mountains, we all know about that. But we don't think about sacred minds. But you're able, because of this other approach to the form, to the natural form, you're able to include something like a mine.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about it's not being only mountains or mines, but it's all kinds of non-living mineral forms like volcanoes or isotopes, mudslides, and so on. And so your objective is to think about how these are intermingled in social life.
mine show up in very interesting ways. And the way people have approached them have changed a lot since 2011 when I got there. You know, people are highly ambivalent about them for obvious reasons. And they act politically in a lot of the ways that mountains act politically. So if we begin with geological forms that are intermingled with acts of human creativity. So before I get to the mine, I'll get to these structures that you see throughout the Mongolian countryside called Owo. So there are these stone cairns, piles of rocks, that when you come across them, you're intended to add a rock or add something to them so that each time you come into contact with them, they gain strength, they gain force as sort of acts of collaborative creativity with the people that pass, with animals as well. Like there are often little voles, silverback voles that live around them that will eat people's offerings that are part of this form. And they're nodes that are used to interface between realms of existence with spirits or with immaterial things, which do also exist on the landscape. And to also engage with destiny, which you'll do with mountains as well. So if you need something, you know, destiny does half the work and then your action does the other half of work. That's kind of a saying that circulates around. So these Owo and this sort of piling up action ends up echoing a lot of times in people's imagination and the way people think about their fortune and their futures with spoil heaps that are formed by pit mines. So you have these rock piles, right, that you might be tempted to, again, put into this binary of sacred and profane. You have, you know, landscape degradation, and then you have sacred thing. But they're both doing very similar things, which is beseeching the future for material fortune, for a change in destiny. Because especially in Sukhbader, when I got there in 2011, Sukhbader was one of the poorest provinces. People had not a lot of money. It was difficult. And there was this zinc mine. And I think in 2012, the government sued the mine. It was a Chinese-owned mine. Sued the mine for back taxes and got just a ton of money. And when you go to Badr or to Sukhbader now, there's a 14-story skyscraper. There's a really fancy hotel. Like people feel more in control when it comes to their financial destinies. And that's not to say people don't feel complicated about it. Like people are also like very much aware of the environmental harm that comes with mining.
The pile of rocks that resulted from the digging of the mine is directly implicated in the wealth that people have been able to generate in that area, thanks really to that pile of rock. But do people worship the pile of mining refuse?
No. It's sort of more of a like an uncanny double. It has resonance. And people appreciate it, but no, people wouldn't go to a spoil heap and bring offerings. People do sometimes, when a mining project starts, will go and read poetry to settle down any unearthed energies or unearthed spirits that come out. So there is ritual practice around the mine, especially if there are accidents or something like that, but it's not worship. And people are also very clear, they'll call it sometimes himelbuls, which means like made mountain, artificial mountain, or artificial oval, or something like that.
The stones still are kind of requesting action and giving results in certain ways, is what you're saying, right?
Yes. And that's part of the way people engage with these things as persons, is that they want things, they desire things. And the reason the word magnetic comes up is they pull things towards you. Alta Nova, in particular, is known for once you meet this mountain, it will like keep trying to pull you back. And this could be in many ways. I think I write about it appearing in people's dreams when you're supposed to go back, when it's calling you back. But there's also kind of this, kind of a joke, but I've experienced it as well, that it's really easy to get into Dedagong. So it's this really small town. Alta Nova is right on the edge. So there's like no point in town where you can't see it. It's very much looms over the town. It's very easy to get there. Very difficult to leave. Nobody ever gets out without some kind of car trouble. I mean, obviously people do, but I've noticed a pattern and people joke about it. Alta Nova doesn't want people to leave.
Yeah. what you're calling these commingling of the geologic and the social.
Yes.
And that's called geosociality.
Yes. Yes. And Dandenong in particular, when I had gotten to Sukhbader, when you join the Peace Corps for the first 3 months, you're not supposed to leave your site. But me and my good friend, Dawa, she's like, no, I need to take you to Dandenong immediately. Alta Novo needs to see you and recognize you. And so in sort of the middle of the school day, she came by and she's like, we're going, and stuck me out. We drove 4 hours to the province capital to Dandenong. And it was, I mean, it is an experience. Like, Dandenong does, the word that's coming to mind is bewitched. But it does pull you when you become entangled with this being. There's like this third thing that's formed of you and it. That I think is kind of what happens. Alta Novo in particular is very magnetic in that way. Part of the mountains in Mongolia thing is they all have very different characters. Alta Novo in particular is known for being very gentle, very forgiving, not demanding very much, for liking foreigners and liking travelers. So I would feel comfortable engaging with Alta Novo in a way that I wouldn't maybe with other mountains that are a little more aggressive or demanding. As far as kinship between the mountains, there's sort of an interesting story from Sukhbader involving Alta Novo and some of the little sibling mountains. So there's one a little bit closer to the province capital named Halsa Novo, who's known for being really, the word is dokshin, sometimes translated as ferocious, but I think like aggressive is a little better. And there's this story people tell where there was some local politician who was supposed to do like a trash cleanup around Halsa Novo and instead pocketed the money. And immediately after this, terrible things started happening. The government building burned down, was struck by lightning, car accidents. His life went poorly. And the mountain killed a few people in that time as well. And the thought was, well, we're not going to go directly to Halsa Novo because it's beyond right now. So we'll go to Alta Novo, the older sibling, to sort of use this kinship network. And by talking to Alta Novo, then Halsa Novo will kind of settle down. So that's the mountain kinship. Alta Novo also has a relationship with Otkontengar, who's a mountain in the west, which is one of the sort of more very powerful, very ferocious mountains in Mongolia. It's known for causing a plane crash in the 60s. There were people flying over it and it crashed into the side. And Alta Novo has a cedar trunk from Otkontengar planted on the top of it to kind of cement that kinship relation. There's a book by poet Gombo Jabing Mind Oyo called Alta Novo that talks about this sort of thing, that they're like antenna that connect them. So that's one. But then yes, people and the mountain also have a kinship relationship. You have this relationship with the mountain because you owe it something because of this kinship relationship, and it also takes care of you, and that there's kind of a mutual sacrifice going on there. But then I was thinking kind of recently after talking with one of my friends that it might be more like a teacher relationship, which in Mongolia is closer to a parental relationship than it would be here. And it's these kinship relationships are formed through individuals, but also through descent lines. So there's a poet, Ochebatin Dashbalber, who specifically talks about Alta Novo as a kinship point where you go to meet your ancestors and your descendants with the knowledge that all your ancestors have gone and all your descendants will go. So you have kinship with the mountain, and the mountain also produces kinship among people.
To go back a little bit to your critique of this life-centric view of nature, and specifically the kind of problem that we have with the word alive in English. Your alternative that you mentioned earlier that you use in your work is lively. Can you talk about how liveliness, what liveliness means and how it enlivens the non-biological entities that you're working with?
The way that I'm thinking of liveliness is in terms of affect. So in terms of one body's ability to provoke response or movement in another. And there's echoes of biology in the way people talk about mountains. So people will talk about the mountains having veins and having blood and there being energy that flows in the veins of the mountain. So it looks lifelike or lively, but it's not biological life, and people know that. I'm also thinking of it in the way that mountains do things and that mountains create. So there's a poetry reader, Mokzaya, in Daragang, and his thought about how poetry is produced. It's never produced through a single human author. It's produced through collaboration between human author and mountain, or human author and steppe or grass. So I would say affect from one body to another is one part way I'm thinking about it.
That's a good segue to talking about animism and then new animism, and how you're reacting to a tradition in anthropology of animism. Could you expand on that a little bit for someone who's not familiar with those concepts?
Yeah. So this goes back to this misunderstanding that applies mistakenness onto people's understanding of landscape. So there's this tradition in anthropology, and we talk about old, quote unquote, old animism, and particularly Tylorian animism, thinking about animism as a mistaken belief in spirits, or imagining spirits or non-embodied entities existing in entities that don't have them, right? So again, like this reinscribing of the mind-body division, Cartesian dualism. Then I think about writers like Descola, who talks about animism as one of multiple ontologies in which people recognize similarity or difference with non-humans through either shared inner and outer forms, like shared material form or shared soul or spirit or mind form. And he posits four different things. But again, he's reinscribing this idea that there's a material world and an immaterial world, and they're separate, and they may be configured differently. So I want to move away from the assumption that people don't know the world that they're living in. And I want to move away from resting on this assumption of a difference between mind and body, especially working through the Mongolian concept of setgil. So the mind body, the affect, the feeling that is both embodied and emotional and mental. And then as far as the new animism, I'm drawing on some of the work that identifies what we might call animism as a philosophy of immanence, the idea that the thing isn't the thing. So again, the mountain is lively because it's a mountain, not because there's a spirit in it. Although there are spirits around and in it, but that's not the thing that's working here. You know, so I think about thinkers like Elizabeth Pavanelli, Jane Bennett, writers that are looking at materiality as containing the thing that people are engaging with.
Yeah, rather than looking for some internal essence, which is like a soul or something in a thing that makes it of value.
Right.
Yeah, so I was really intrigued by your section on the concept energy.
Yes.
And am I saying that word right? Or
yeah, so people pronounce it two different ways. They'll say energy, like the Russian pronunciation, or people also say endrek, which is the more Mongolian pronunciation, but either one is, you could say energy too. People would
okay, energy. That. So you, just for the listener, you spell it E-N-E-R-G-I. And so that's what I was asking about the pronunciation of, but I'll just say energy since my Russian is rusty. And you describe it as a loanword from Russian that first came into usage in Mongolian in the mid-20th century. But then it brings in to it all of these pre-Russian and Mongolian ideas. And so it becomes this very rich way of exploring these intangible forces in the natural environment. Could you expand a little bit on this concept?
Sure. Endrek is, it's a really interesting concept because it has a multitude of meanings that are sometimes contradictory, but also simultaneously exist, and that get appropriated in all these interesting ways. So talking about the pre-socialist modernization campaign and thinking about energy or Endrek, people wouldn't have used that word, but the thing that people now call Endrek, sort of this concept that there are these collections of affective abilities, of powers, of entities that exist on the landscape and make things happen, and can be transferred between human bodies and geological bodies, or between plants and people as well. There's a book by Morten Peterson called Not Quite Shamans, and he talks about that there's, in the Darfur Depression where he works, that there's this one particular berry that has a creative energy called Oran that people will take, and it will make them more poetic or more able to think creatively. So there's this pre-socialist concept that then gets taken up and gets called Endrik. And that also means power and electricity and light, and gets also used in these really interesting ways. There's another anthropologist named Saskia Abrams-Kovanenko who talks about light in that era and how electricity during the socialist era in Mongolia was called Lenin's light. And it was like the light of enlightenment, of modernization, and of movement away from superstition. But that then gets very interestingly re-entangled after the transition in the 90s back into concepts of Buddhist enlightenment. But then Endrik also gets appropriated post-transition of the 90s into capitalism and capital. So at Hamarinhid, which is Hamar Temple in the Gobi Desert, it's a pilgrimage site that people colloquially call an energy center. So there's the temple that was set up by the Danzan Ravja, a Nyingma saint in the 19th century. And then there's also this patch of iron oxidized soil, so this dark red soil that is a place where people go to like renew themselves after being exhausted by capitalism. And, you know, it's said that the earth itself contains Endrik for lots of different reasons, which I'll explain in a second. But you could take a train down from Ulaanbaatar to Hamarinhid, overnight train. So people will leave on Friday, go down after work. It's mostly women in their late 20s and 30s. So like the exhausted woman is a trope in contemporary Mongolian life. There's actually a remake of 12 Angry Men that's coming out, and one of the jurors is the exhausted woman. So it's like very much a type. So a bunch of exhausted women will go down on the train overnight, get to Hamarinhid, spend a day at the energy center, sort of re-up, and then take the train back next day. And it's a huge tourist destination, like specifically for this idea to renew your energy for labor.
It sounds like a spa.
It's spa-like for sure. So you go, and the area where the actual energy center is located is called Shambhala, which is interesting in and of itself. So people will go, you take off your shoes, you just kind of like lay there, and you have to touch the red stone with your skin, the bottoms of your feet, your palms. People have picnics, they hang out. There are sort of other forms in that area. It's kind of a complex, and it is kind of a spa pilgrimage. Yeah, now that I think about it. There's a cave complex called the Mother Cave, and you're supposed to crawl through. It's like this kind of honeycombed form. You're supposed to crawl through the holes and be reborn, which means like renewed to go back to work. You can walk along the edge of the rock and press your body up against it. It's supposed to heal any like exhaustion-related injuries. Yeah, it's a very interesting place. Actually, Forbes just came out with an article about it a few days ago. The fact that Forbes is writing about it, it really, I think, it shows how this concept of Endrik can really, like, has really, really been appropriated by capitalism in the last couple decades.
So how does the Earth have this energy? Like, what does it mean for the Earth to have?
So there are a couple different explanations that I've heard. I've heard people say that it's because of the iron deposits. Taking iron gives you energy. You can absorb it through your skin. So this kind of like a secularist explanation. There's also, as part of this circuit that you do, there's a part where you go up to this obol. So there's a rock pile dedicated to Danzan Ravja, who's also a poet, and you recite this one poem of his called Your Perfect Qualities, which is an ode to a perfected female body. And the thought is, and what people will say is, people reciting this poem to this piece of land, it will imbue the land with energy, you reciting this poem. There's this way that language works in Mongolia where language isn't just semiotic, it also is material. So it's this idea that saying things makes things happen. So in reciting this poem about a sort of healed, perfected, beautiful female body, you're creating an essence of that. And you can then take that back from the land itself. And then there are people that have these new agey explanations. Somebody told me that it was because aliens had visited there. Somebody said it was a vortex like they have in Sedona. Like there's all sorts of explanations.
What other kinds of places have energy?
Yes. So another great story is your birthplace has energy that you can get. Like only you can get energy from your birthplace. So actually this summer I was in Mongolia. I went with two women who are going to their birthplace in the Gobi Desert. And they go every year. They have kind of a family reunion. Everybody goes to visit their birthplace. And you go and you take your clothes off and you roll around in the dirt and the place you were born. And it renews your energy from, again, this physical contact between you and your birthplace. And I had asked one of the women who was doing this, well, what happens if you're born in a hospital? And she goes, I mean, you could roll around in the hospital, but they don't let you do that. So it's a practice that's dying out. And an interesting thing that happened on that trip is the way people were locating their birthplace was through finding wells. So this well used to be here. We could find it in terms of this well because it's very flat. There aren't a lot of obvious landmarks. But there was a mine that had actually just been raided a year before. It was a silver mine. And because of this mine, all the wells had dried up in that area. And so one of the people I went with was unable to find her birthplace because there were no longer wells to triangulate with. And so she just kind of had to guess.
Is it a quality that it exists only in the earth, or can it be in trees or in water?
Could definitely be in trees and in water. There's a spring attached to a lake that's near Altanowol in Daegang in the east. That's also one of these places that's very energetic and one of these places that creates the character landscape named Ganganor, Gang Lake. And that's a place that has a lot of energy. Drinking spring water can give you energy. There's a type of barbecue where you'll cook meat with hot stones. And then when you pull the hot stones out, you kind of like toss them in your hands and that will give you energy. It gets involved in feng shui. So having, you know, certain crystals in certain places in your house, stones themselves, carrying certain stones themselves, all sorts of ways.
Is it related then to mining? Because if we get energy out of the
yes.
earth.
Yeah. And uranium mining in particular slots right into this concept of energy coming from the landscape, and also has really complicated things for people. It was illegal to mine uranium, I think, from 2015 until pretty recently. And they recently lifted the ban. And now French companies are going in and starting uranium mines, which people are partially happy about, especially since the invasion of Ukraine. Because people are very nervous about getting oil and gas from Russia for obvious reasons. So, you know, people want their own source of energy because Mongolia is a very uranium-rich country. But people are also aware of cancer rates going up because of uranium mining or the dangers of radiation.
So you write about your interactions with the field of energy humanities, which I admit I had never heard of. I'm so excited now to go do some research on that. And especially this book by Kara New Daggett,
yes.
The Birth of Energy from 2019, who writes about the cause of climate crisis not being about what kind of fuel sources we use to produce energy, but rather the very way we think about what energy is.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so interesting to me. I wonder if you could say a bit more about that and how you can see your research in Mongolia and this concept of energy kind of offering some new ways of thinking about these
yeah.
topics.
Yeah. So one of Daggett's big calls is to provincialize concepts of energy. What my work can offer is mostly descriptive to show that there are other ways of thinking about it. Like we don't have to think about it just as fuel. And looking at the way that landscape energies, pre-socialist and socialist landscape energies get appropriated into capitalism, if we can trace that, we can undo it a little bit. So answering her call in particularizing different concepts and showing that there are alternatives and excesses to this category that has been so overtaken by the idea of energy as like labor fuel or combustible fuel or fuel for capital, fuel for empire.
Right. I can really see that. I really saw the value of your work in giving us new ways to think about those concepts, which seem, of course, so relevant and important right now.
What I've really been looking at recently and beginning to explore focuses in on uranium mining and of histories of uranium mining, particularly between Mongolia and the Czech Republic. So my grandfather was a uranium miner in the Czech Republic. So I have kind of this history with it. And then when I was in Mongolia, I kept seeing these resonances between Czech histories of uranium mining and Mongolian histories of uranium mining. So there's this place further north from my main field site in Dornod province, right on the Russian border, called Marde. And it's a defunct uranium mine. it was a secret town, so no Mongolians could enter. It was only for Russian workers. It was a uranium mine. You would get shot on sight if you got close to it. And people in the area sort of have these memories. Like they'll say, no bird could fly over Mare. It has a lot of imaginative power. But then in 1991, suddenly all the Russian employees were pulled back to Russia overnight, and it was just open. And it was this sort of open air treasure because people, it was just left behind. So people went and they stripped it for copper and stripped it for parts. And it transformed then into this positive thing because it was this gift that was left, as the way people, a lot of people see it. And now it's a grazing land. And again, this idea of energy comes up because I remember asking some of the herders who graze their animals on this land, aren't you afraid of radioactive contamination? They're kind of like, oh, Americans, you're so afraid of radiation. You're so paranoid. Little bits of radioactivity are fine. And in fact, it's energy, so it's good for the animals. And that is something that I'd heard also in the Czech Republic about low-dose radiation. So there are spas in the Czech Republic where you go and you can soak in radon water. And it was the same thing. It was like, why Americans are so paranoid. And so that was kind of interesting to me. Why are there these similar orientations towards radiation from these places that seem very far away? And then I also learned that Mare, apparently the deposit, was explored by Czech geologists who had been working in uranium mines in the Czech Republic. So there are all these kind of interesting resonances that came up. So the energy question, particularly around radioactivity and uranium and how it sort of ties distant places together, is a question I'm working on now.
Oh, that is such a great project. I'm so excited to read more about that. Thank you so much. This has been so interesting. I love your work so much, and I'm so grateful that you've taken the time to share with me.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. This is really fun, and it's fun to think through things more.
This episode of Buddhist Studies Footnotes was created, produced, and edited by me, Frances Garrett, with support from the Robert H. N. Ho Family Foundation Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Toronto. This project aims to make Buddhist studies research freely available to students and the public.